Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
I'm feeling epic.
Epic?
Yes, I'm feeling cinematic.
That's
epic.
That's a nice feeling.
I'm also feeling quite sensual.
Oh, what?
Yes, because it's all inspired by today's guest and her incredible work.
Right.
Which I have been following for a number of years.
Good.
And first properly focused on it actually when she had the show at Tetley in the north of England.
In Leeds.
In Leeds. Because one of the artists I work with, Jessie Flood Paddock, also did a show at Tetley maybe like a year before.
I remember
or
that.
6 months before or something like that. So I started to sort of really keep an eye on that particular program because I really love that space and I love the curators and I loved everyone I met in Leeds. And that was kind of why I then, was paying attention and then suddenly realised that I had met our guest when I was like about 22 or something and I was working as a PR guy to make money and I did PR for this ghost train, which was organised by an artist and performance artist called Marissa Karneski. And it was this ghost train with lots of different characters in it. And
An art ghost train?
Yeah, but it was an actual train that you would... They kind of reconstructed this old, like, fairground ride. It was amazing.
Well, right.
And they even had this guy from, like, Harry Potter who did, like, the sort of special effects and visual effects so that when you went into each kind of chamber or room, it would have, like, all these amazing mystical things happen. It was actually kind
Where was it? In London?
Yeah, it was in Truman Brewery, but I think it toured all over the UK. And another person in it who I sort of followed since then was Paloma Faith as well. And I remember going to a gig of hers about, I don't know, 6 months after, and she was doing this kind of like rockabilly music and it was in like Café de Paris or somewhere. And I remember watching her and thinking like, this woman's incredible. Like she's a pop star, but the music wasn't quite, it was almost like she was working with Jarvis Cocker. Or I can't quite remember it now, but she had this kind of very different thing going on. And then like a few years later, she, you know, turned up as Paloma Faith, as this iconic kind of
Brit Award winner.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just interesting to see the evolution, though, of creative people.
Yes.
Why I've brought this up. And because you and I have both experienced that ourselves. And I really respect how true to herself our guest is. Because I think even back then, you had such a strong sense of self. Like, and I really remembered you as one of the kind of main faces in that ghost train, if that makes sense. Even though it wasn't like your name on the ghost train, but I remember you had such presence and you still do to this day. And I think it's growing and growing. And I'm so happy for you that you got nominated for the Turner Prize and have since become a joint winner of the Turner Prize, which is very, very cool.
Yeah.
And our guest has work in the Arts Council collection and is exhibiting all over the world. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Ty Shani.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's interesting that memory, that kind of thing that happened so long ago, and actually was a little bit my introduction. I was very young, and I met Marissa Karneski in an elevator.
Really?
Yeah. We were going to Aretha Sherry's for a birthday party, and she was like, do you want to come and join the circus?
Who's Aretha Sherry?
She's an artist as well. She's a really brilliant artist who's been making work for a really long time, but also, like, I feel has been getting more recognition that she deserves.
Great. And throws a good party?
Very good party. This was like East London in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And I met Marissa and she's this incredibly charismatic character. And I think, you know, it's also interesting thinking about the people she chose to be in it, because a lot of the people, not just Paloma and myself, but a lot of the people, you know, have continued making work and like really interesting work. So it's a testament also, I think, to her kind of, I don't know, sensibility that she chose these people to be in it. And Paul Keeve was the name of the illusionist.
Oh, Harry Potter
illusionist.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Right. And he put together these, and he taught us sleight of hand.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so it was quite...
I love a sleight of hand.
Yeah,
I love close-up magic at a party. That's magic.
He taught me a little bit. I wasn't very good, I have to say, but he did teach me how to, you know, make a card disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you still like got that skill?
No, I think I'd need to put in a few hours of refresher.
If you give me a cigarette and some sellotape, I can make it disappear.
Can you?
Yeah. I'm really good at that trick. So do you feel, talking about the 2000s and East London and the art scene, do you feel a nostalgia for a time like that? Because I've read somewhere that you felt that the art scene isn't like that anymore.
I try to resist nostalgia because I think it's inevitable with age in a way. Mm. But I do try and resist, you know, this idea that things were always better before. I think it's not a really constructive way to think about life.
Mm.
But I do, there are things I miss about it or that I think are a shame that have been lost, which is, I think there was a much more diverse kind of ecosystem in terms of places that people could show work than there is today.
Right.
And that, I think, is missing. Mm-hmm. You know, there were lots of places that were artist-run spaces that didn't really have, you know, they were a means to an end in themselves. They weren't really thinking about becoming commercial galleries or becoming part of any institution. That was all they served, was a place, a kind of social community place where artists could show work, really interesting programs. Some of them did go on to become either commercial galleries or the curators went on to work in institutions. But I think, you know, the fact that there was affordable places in London that you could put on things.
Mm.
And I certainly, my career started by putting on performances in weird venues, you know, and that's something that now I don't think I'd be able to do with the kind of financial resources I had.
The infrastructure that's sort of there for emerging artists.
Yeah, I mean, and they're very, very, like, there are infrastructures, but they're very kind of strict in a way, and they're very institutionalized already, you know, so you can get like their prizes, their awards, there are all these things, but there isn't any like real space for artists to self-organize in the way that they used to be. And I thought that when I came to London, that's what blew my mind. I remember going to a place called Trade Apartment in Brixton, and it was just like, yeah, it was this sense of having arrived in something really vibrant and exciting, and that wasn't sanctioned by, you know, people with a lot of power, really.
Mm.
You know what's interesting? I obviously run the gallery in Margate, and you've just had your work at the Turner Contemporary as part of the Turner Prize in Margate. And partly why I'm enjoying living in Margate and why I've moved there full time is that exact reason, because I feel like people are putting on exhibitions in their flats.
Yeah.
And it really reminds me of earlier time.
Excellent.
And it's, I keep telling everyone I feel like I'm 14 years old again.
Yeah.
But I think that is probably the sad thing, is it won't be in London anymore. That whole kind of, it'll still happen, but I think it will happen in like Lisbon, or it might happen like just other places.
Mm.
But then it's a shame, because London is such an amazing place. And it's got so much to offer.
Totally. And there's so many amazing people here as well.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I do feel that a lot of people that are maybe, you know, like, I don't want to use the word ambitious, because that kind of places it within a specific type of mode of creation. But I do think that there are people that maybe don't have the same ambitions, you know, that want to have more of maybe a kind of autonomy around their work. You know, for them, I think they do get pushed out of the city.
Right, right.
You know, I do. And I think that's a shame. I really do. Yeah.
So thinking about performance, which is a central part to everything that you do in a way, and always has been, I think, you were making performances a long time before times like Instagram, and even the way it's so easy to record things now on telephones and document things. So when you were starting to make performances, it was kind of quite an unusual situation, I guess. Can you talk a bit about how different it was when you started out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's actually beyond the performance thing. I think it's interesting seeing how images are propagated through social media and social networks, and seeing how, you know, often people feel like they've seen the work because they've seen a photograph of it. So I think that there is something about that that's a bit, can be like weird, where I, you know, like when I...
But you like it though?
I'm a very, very active, and I think it's an amazing thing. And I've had a website since 2005.
Oh, right.
Pilangalia Collective gave me for Christmas my domain, like taishani.com. And I really...
Was it like, and they pay for your domain
every
year?
No. They just, you know, you could buy a domain, register it. So that was their Christmas present one year. It's really nice. And at the time, people were very snobby about the internet. You know, they were like, why would you have your work there? You know, like, it means that everyone can see it. And I was like, yeah, exactly. Everyone could see it then. So, I mean, that's the thing is that I've always been really interested in the idea of having as much access as possible. I think where it becomes weird is, like, for example, when I heard about being nominated, I knew that that image of the performance in Glasgow had been seen a lot.
Right.
And that was something that I was thinking about, like, should I recreate that in, you know, reconfigure it for the space or do something different? Because I did feel that there was this sense of like, oh yeah, I know that because I've seen that image on Instagram.
Right. So to almost encourage new visitors or even the same people to come again.
Yeah, exactly.
You need,
so
yeah.
You were nominated for a show in Glasgow called Dark Continent.
I call it DC Semiramis.
DC Semiramis.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that. So Semiramis is a fictional medieval town built for women.
No.
It's the leader of the town, the goddess. No.
She was an Assyrian warrior queen.
Okay.
And in the book that I've adapted, which is called The Book of the City of Ladies by Christine de Pizan, which is a medieval book.
Yes.
Within which she creates a city of women. The first stone that she places, like the cornerstone of her city, is
like the
Semiramis.
Foundation stone.
Exactly. So all the building blocks in her city are different women. So that was her first one. And since I'm quite interested in like scale, and I thought I wanted to take one of the blocks of her city and make that, do you know what I mean?
Like make that as whole one world.
Exactly.
As one, right, okay.
Microcosm, macrocosm thing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you made the world of Semiramis, you kind of went macro on it.
Yeah.
And then within that, it's like a performance goes on and you have 12 characters.
Yes, but it's also an ongoing project that happened over 5 years. So many of the actual episodes, so I think of them as episodes as opposed to characters, really.
Okay.
So a lot of the episodes have been performed in different configurations before. So, for example, the one you mentioned earlier, the podcast for The Serpentine's Miracle.
Oh yeah, because there's an amazing podcast on Apple and Spotify, which you can listen to free, from The Serpentine, which is an audio documentation of a performance that
Ty
did at
Serpentine. So that one is one of the characters. So the characters kind of, the city started building itself in an imaginary way, not in like a kind of real way and not in a material way. But I've often referred to it as a city in time and not in space. So there have been many iterations over the years of the different episodes or characters.
Uh-huh.
But this Semiramis was the first time that all 12 were together, because I knew at some point. So I tried a few years ago, I really tried to get this project off the ground, which was like a Roman orgy that was going to last for 29 days.
What, as a performance?
Yeah, and that each performer would have their body double, like as a kind of dummy, you know, like one of the, you know, these kind of like perfect dummies.
Yeah.
And that it would be this...
Well, like a mimic of them.
Yeah, like, yeah. You know how like if, as an actor, if you die...
Oh, a body double type thing.
Yeah, kind of thing. So, you know, that they could cut open or whatever.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so there'd be this perfect body double and it would last 29 days. It was like a really epic kind of idea. No one, and people, you know, A, thought I was mad. B, were like, this will never, ever, ever happen kind of thing. And then, so I kind of scaled it down. But then I started researching into medieval mysticism and came across that book, The Book of the City of Ladies. And I've done lots of adaptations before. So I thought, I'm going to adapt this. But then instead of like, you know, like blowing my load in meetings, like I want to do a 12-hour performance or whatever, I started just being like, oh, okay, I'm going to develop a character for each opportunity I got. So the first time was at the Hayward Gallery for their Mirror City exhibition.
Yeah.
They commissioned the first kind of iteration of the project, which were three characters.
And who were these characters?
The medieval mystic, the Neanderthal, and...
the vampire?
No, Woman on the Edge of Time, which is going back to a kind of seminal feminist science fiction book called by Marge Piercy. Yeah.
And you create an inner monologue for these characters.
Yeah, that's right.
And you write that yourself.
Yeah.
And then you have performers, dancers, actors who you audition to play these characters.
No. Yes and no. I mean, there's often, I work with often the same, there's a narrator,
right,
usually. And I work with...
Is that ever yourself? Because your voice is never featured, is it?
No, no.
Never, you wouldn't do that?
Never, no, no.
And have you ever performed in your own...
I did, yeah. When I first started
doing
performances, I was the main kind of character.
Yeah, of course you're going to be the lead.
Yeah, of course. But then I... but it was because I'd come from... I guess before... I started out as a fashion photographer, mm-hmm. and then I started making videos. And then when I came to London, I didn't know anyone here. And it just made sense. I bought a camera. And I think a lot of like practices start that way, where I just used myself, not out of any kind of like huge conceptual remit. It was just like I was available and I was free.
Right.
So I used myself initially in my work. So when I started doing performances, it made sense for me to be that person as well.
Yeah.
But then I quickly realized that it was much more interesting to have other people for me. You know,
yeah.
In it and be able to look from outside and not have to, as well as direct people, be inside it.
Would you say you're an ideas person?
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's the fundamentals of your practice.
Yeah. But I really enjoy making.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy writing as well. But writing is ideas. And so is making in a way. But I think the points where I'm really, really in some kind of form of ecstasy is within the ideas.
And when you're creating the
idea. It's the idea, definite, that is the bit where I feel very kind of at the service of something, if that makes sense.
A higher being is kind of coming through you and creating the work.
I don't know if it's a higher being. It's but, you know, like I feel very kind of...
In touch, connected,
very connected.
Well, that harks back to your, because you were always destined to be an artist because you grew up in a hippie commune, can we say commune?
Yeah.
In Goa and then in Belgium.
Yeah.
And all of your family were artists.
They were all creative. My aunt is an artist. She had the paintings that were in the Turner Prize exhibition outside. Those are...
There are 12 of them, aren't there?
Yeah, exactly.
And each is a different...
For each character.
Is it a star sign?
Zodiac.
Yeah. Is it a star sign, Zodiac? Is that the same thing?
Yeah.
I always get nervous when I talk about star signs because I don't actually know anything about it.
Fine.
But yeah, so it's 12 star signs, 12 signs of the Zodiac.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it made sense because you were trying to involve your auntie, but you thought that was perfect because you have 12 characters.
Yeah, exactly.
So it kind of fitted.
Yeah.
I really wanted to talk about your auntie because I loved this idea that you spoke about how it's what a privilege it was to grow up around, like Russell's saying, in this commune of people who were so creative. Because a lot of people, you might become an artist as some kind of rebellion against, you know, social norms.
Authority
almost.
Or
like I just heard, it was David Bowie's birthday the other day, and I heard him talking about this idea of social dysfunction and how... most artists are actually just socially dysfunctional because you're rebelling against something. But what I loved about your story is, in a way, it's not really social dysfunction, even if we are still separate from the main society and we have different objectives and different ideas.
Mm.
But there's something so generous about the community that you grew up in.
Yeah, so who else?
Particularly
you had your auntie.
I love the story.
But who else was creative then?
My mum was an actress and then she became a photographer.
Mm.
My dad wrote and everyone around us made stuff. If you see what I mean.
Wow.
So like once a year there was, I guess you'd call it like a talent show, but it was mainly directed by this very transgressive, weird Dutch theatre company
mm-hmm.
that spent a lot of time in Goa. And they would like put together this show and you could, you know, it wasn't like cohesive, like everyone could put a little bit in it, kind of.
Like a sketch.
Yeah. But it was all very, like, you can imagine mystical and psychedelic and, like, you know, like a crystal pyramid that at dawn the sun would hit. You know, my first kind of sense of regret was during one of these shows where someone directed all the kids to come down this cliff. There was, like, a little footpath by the cliff holding, like, lit torches and wearing, like, these togas.
Mm-hmm.
And all the kids were going to come down it with these crowns made out of leaves. And after the rehearsal, my crown was, I think someone stepped on it or something, and mm-hmm. it was broken. And I refused to do it because my crown was broken. Like, you know, this kind of headdress.
You were a diva?
Yeah, I was like...
You went full diva mode.
I was like five-year-old diva.
And psychedelic diva.
Five-year-old diva. And I was so sad because then I was at the foot of the cliff and everyone had bonfires. And I lay on my mum's legs and then all the kids came down and it in a procession. And it was so beautiful. Mm. And I was so angry at myself that I'd been so, like, petty.
Yeah.
About this stupid, like,
and you remember
headdress.
That feeling still?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And did you know then, I'll never do that again?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So becoming an artist felt like the norm. I suppose if you'd said, I want to be an accountant, everyone would have been like, what?
You say that, but lots of the kids I grew up with have done really straight jobs.
So and they've rebelled actually,
yeah,
against
exactly.
that.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah,
their
yeah.
rebellion.
That's quite a common thing,
yeah,
though, isn't
yeah,
it? Yeah. So in a way, I guess your family probably really were hoping one day you would be an artist in the world, you know, making your voice heard.
Yeah.
And what with your auntie, what was it like? Because I heard the story of you going into her studio and just the idea that someone is kind of making work every day
yeah.
as their job
yeah.
and that being a possibility.
Yeah. And the fact that that was her whole, you know, that was her identity, that was her life, you know, and that's how she kind of communicated with people. Like, I remember always she'd paint gifts, you know, like, as it was just like always around us, this idea of her doing exhibitions, her painting.
Or like Christmas and birthdays, you get presents she'd made.
Yeah, or yeah. like, you know, I remember she'd make a box for my dad or I'd pose for her. You know, there was always like this kind of awareness that that was her life.
Yeah.
So, and also the kind of story, you know, like she would tell me really imaginative, invent like these really imaginative children's stories about crystal worlds and like very hippie kind of stuff. But like, you know, it was very open. And I think my creativity was always very encouraged, you know, as a kid, always to draw, write. You know, that was the main focus, really.
Didn't you go and study at 13 at a major art?
I did.
Establishment.
But it's true, but it's a very different system in Belgium.
Right.
So in Belgium, you could at the age of 13, like go to the Beaux-Arts.
Yeah. Which is the Beaux-Arts?
It's like the main. It's like the Royal College or the.
So a big time.
It's a big yeah, but it's still high school, but you're already kind of specializing in something. I don't know if that, in something. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I don't know if it still exists even that system, but you could do that back then and you would spend like your last three or four or five years. You'd still do all the other things.
Yeah.
But you had like art was a major part of your curriculum basically.
Your practice, right.
But I didn't last very long there.
Why?
Because it was in French.
Right.
And I spoke French, but like I needed a lot of help with like mathematics and I just couldn't keep up.
Because of growing up in the hippie commune.
Yeah, I had to go to like, I had to be helped like when I finally went to school. Like I
that's when you were about 10.
I was 10.
Yeah.
So I couldn't read or write.
So you hadn't been to school until you were 10 years old?
No.
And how do you feel about that now looking back? Are you.
It was good.
You had a good time, right?
It was good. And also, like, I caught up really quickly eventually. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
I finished when I was 16.
And you've been quite self-taught the whole of your life. So you've never done, like, much art, a formal, like, art education that's, like, have you?
No, but I wanted to.
I did.
So when I finished school, I went to Israel. My mum moved back to Israel to be with her family. And I moved back with her. And there I did go to photography. I did study fine art photography.
Okay, right.
But I left in the middle of a crit.
Right.
Like, very dramatic.
What, another diva?
Yeah. It's like being sensitive. It's not me. I couldn't deal with being criticised in that way. Like, not...
But like an authoritarian figure criticising you.
Exactly.
Or can friends criticise your work and it's easier?
No, now I don't care. Now I'm up for it completely. But I was very insecure. I was 18.
Yeah.
And my dad had just passed away. And I just wasn't really able to kind of withstand. You know, you know, it was very different then. Like, I teach now. And the kind of nonsense that people would say then was so unacceptable.
Like what? Yeah.
Like, oh, you're never going to be an artist if you can't give a name to your work. You know, like, just stupid.
If you can't title your work.
Yeah, stupid stuff like that.
These sort of critiques at the time were just really...
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, look, I've been very lucky as well. You know, I've had very good fortune and... I didn't get into any art school. I came to London in 2001, applied everywhere, three times, everywhere. and didn't get anywhere. Like, I didn't get in anywhere.
But what was their feedback? What was their reasons
why? I never even got feedback.
Really?
So they would have to give you feedback wow. now, right? Would they?
Now it's a different... Higher education's really different. This was like... It was still free then. It was much harder to get in.
Right.
I never got, you know, like an interview even in any of those places.
So what kept you going? Have you just always had to create?
I mean, it sounds cheesy, but yeah. like I think I wouldn't be alive today if I didn't make work.
Right.
You know, so it's really the thing that makes like everything. It's
sense.
What makes sense and bearable. It's how I understand the world. It's how I feel anchored to something. You know, like I'm a very anxious person.
Right.
It's the only thing that kind of keeps my anxiety. It generates different anxieties, but, you know, this kind of existential dread, it's the only thing that kind of keeps me functioning, really. So, like, it was never an option not to do it, you know.
And do you think, having grown up in, like, a commune where you're around a lot of people and it's quite a kind of, it seems like, from the outside, quite a sociable experience in a way, do you think that is also why you've enjoyed being such a wonderful collaborator? Because you've collaborated with so many interesting yeah. people, and there's a few people that I adore, like Florence Peake. I know you've worked a bit with her. And also
Wising, wasn't it?
And, yeah. In Wising, yeah. And also Let's Eat Grandma, who are an amazing duo, musician duo, who I just think are visionary, incredible people.
And an amazing name.
Yeah. But also within your work, you have like 12 characters. You have all these people. So it's a big, it's almost like on an epic kind of film scale, like an opera or something. You have this kind of like art.
Yeah, I mean, I look at your work and I think, when are you doing the opera?
Wow, when?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
The work I was doing before all this started,
yeah.
actually, those weird performances in like unlikely places,
yeah.
they had way more people in them.
Really?
Yeah, some of them had like 45 people.
No way.
Yeah.
Where would you find them, and would you give them parameters?
Well, that's what I mean. Like that. So two things. One is that I think calling me a collaborator is very generous. Like with Florence, that was definitely a collaboration, but I see myself as more as a cooperative person.
Okay.
Because there are very strict parameters that I, you know, like I'll give people total freedom. You know, like Let's Eat Grandma, I really loved their first album when I heard it on the radio, and I approached them immediately. And I just kind of, you know, gave them like a few references, but I don't sit there going like, okay, now make it like this or make it. So I do give, you know, freedom within these parameters, but they're things that I would never... you know, allow anyone in on as well.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Kind of.
Like, there are bits that I need... Like, I will never write with someone.
Right.
Ever. You know, there are many things... Like, even when
but I... But you're happy to give your writing to someone to read and then let them do their own...
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
And so you're not like... In your head, that's it. Yeah. But once it's out in the world, then you can do... You can interpret that any way you want.
Totally. And I'm not precious about, you know, like, any of those things. It's just that there are certain parts... of the process that I feel like I need to be very solitary.
But I also think you're so specific in who you're choosing.
Yeah.
So it's almost like if you think of casting an actor or something.
Yeah.
If you're casting for your performances, I feel like the fact you chose Let's Eat Grandma to be the people you're going to be in your thing, that's almost like choosing the colour red.
Exactly.
Or choosing a colour blue.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? It's like such a specific thing. And then, of course, they can let their own souls pour out onto the performance. But you've chosen that.
Yeah. So it's obviously you choose people that have a shared sensibility with you. I've worked a lot more, actually, more closely with Maxwell Sterling, who's done the soundtrack for this last piece I did, which is a virtual reality play. But
wow.
Yeah. So I've been working with him quite a bit. And he did the soundtrack for the Florence Peake and my collaboration as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're not scared of virtual reality or the internet or...
No.
Any of that stuff.
What's there to be afraid of?
Well, I don't know. It's great that you're completely embracing it. So a virtual reality... How does that work?
So you put it on and then inside you're on...
So you've got the headpiece on.
You've got the
headpiece. How many of them do you have?
I own three that are touring with this show, but like it's in Dublin now at Temple Bar Gallery. And they're, I think they're called Digital Hub Ireland.
Okay.
They've provided another eight. So there's, I think they're eight on all the time. And inside it, you are like on the faces of these very old characters.
Yeah.
almost like an ant on someone's face, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So your POV and the depth of field that you can do in the digital world is something that's not possible really in our world.
Yeah.
So I'm using that, this idea of being very, you know, so these faces become like...
So you're like a fly on a wall, but a fly in the face.
A little bit, yeah. And they become like landscapes, you know what I mean? They become like, yeah. And there's a cat called Oedipus. Our cat's called Oedipus as well.
Love that.
And he's one of the characters. And he sings a cover of Outkast, Miss Jackson.
Of course.
Very sad.
What, slowed down?
Yeah, like a really sad version of it.
Oh my God, I want to go and see
it. So you are navigating like the face of these old people, like it's an atlas. So again, it's the micro version,
yeah,
like
exactly.
You've done with Semiramis.
Yeah.
With the rock, the stone, you're kind of macro that.
Yeah.
Now you're doing it on the face of someone with this. Wow.
And it has an installation that goes with it, and the characters are in the installation as well. So like we did 3D prints of the, you know, because they're computer generated, you can just print them in any size as well. So we printed the faces, and they exist as like jewels in a bracelet around a snake, and
they're all kinds
of things. Wow. Yep. Where do you think you get your inspiration from?
Sometimes it can be something quite like silly, or not silly, but like basic, like hearing a song, and there might be a tone to it that I think is really like an emotional tone that I find really resonates in a very abstract way, obviously. And then I try and think about how to recreate that tone in language, either verbal language or objects. So I think sometimes it's stuff like that.
And you hold that tone in your head while you're working through it.
But I read a lot, and there are things that, you know, there are questions as a human that preoccupy me. And I try and kind of find ways to explore them in the work, I guess.
Are you a sci-fi fan?
Yes.
Do you watch sci-fi?
I read and watch, but I'm not like, I'm not very, how can I say it? Like, I don't have like some incredible, profound knowledge in any field, if that makes sense.
But what do you read, like sci-fi wise, what do you read?
I read a lot I read a lot of feminist sci-fi, like Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler. So that was very much thinking for this work. But when I was young, very young, my parents were really... Well, everyone around me were really into science fiction. So the first books I read were also science fiction. So I've always had like that kind of idea that, you know, science fiction is this kind of speculative form that you can really test out ideas that, you know, are very difficult to test out on other platforms.
And in the science fiction, feminist science fiction, I've made a note, proto-feminism.
Yeah.
That's what's exploring in the feminist science fiction.
No, that's like Christine de Pizan, because she wrote this in 1405.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really a thing called feminism. So it's kind of pre-feminism.
Okay.
But like all the, you know, all the kind of 70s, 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s science fiction is part, you know, was part of a kind of political movement, I think, yeah.
Love that.
Which is feminism.
Yeah.
And
what about film?
Yeah.
Because I heard a talk you did once and I found it really fascinating. I think it was like a Q&A or something. And you were saying they were trying to get you to talk about artists that you liked, which there's many that you like.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that, like many other artists that I think are brilliant, often they're not looking necessarily at art because somehow they have to look to other places. And I heard that film is a big thing for you as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, I love... Well, if I think about things that like really blew my mind when I was... I want my mind to be blown, obviously, but I think with age it changes because you do become exposed to more things and it becomes, you know... I don't know if you've probably had that thing where you're like 20 and someone says, oh, look at this thing or listen to this thing. And you're like, what the fuck?
This has changed my life.
It's more difficult with age to encounter these kind of experiences.
Mm.
But I remember, you know, like seeing this film by Hans-Jürgen Cyberberg and the visual language, and it just like kind of...
Is this Valmont?
No, oh no, 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 no. That's more like a kind of teenage crush thing. This is more like my cultural, you know, like when I was already culturally aware.
Uh-huh.
No, Valmont was like my teenage kind of
You watched
obsession.
That 12 times.
I did, yeah. You should watch it again.
When was the last time you watched it?
No, it was in a row. It was
what? You just like went back to back?
Yeah, yeah.
Looped
no,
it?
No, no, no. Day after day, like for a few weeks, I was obsessed. Yeah. It was very obsessive, yeah.
What is Valmont for everyone who's listening?
So it was
Isn't it a recreation of something else.
Well, Dangerous Liaisons.
That's right.
Came out. So I think that was Stephen Frears who did the good one, right. Like the one that people think of as critically interesting.
Yeah, defining. Yeah. Of
defining.
It, yeah.
Yeah. It had Glenn Close in it. I
yes,
think.
Yeah.
And then not long.
Cruel Intentions, didn't we? Was the kind of the American,
exactly,
high school version.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With Ryan Philippe and with somebody. Yeah. Who was in that. Yeah.
And then there was like not long after Milos Forman, who is an interesting director, he did that one. He did his own version, which was called Valmont, because the male character in Dangerous Liaisons is called Valmont.
Right.
And so it was just like, and this one had like, sorry.
Yeah, you can say
Colin Firth in it.
Colin Fuck, was you going to call him?
And who else was it? It was just like a different flavour. You know what I mean? It wasn't as, like, the other one had like Uma Thurman. You know, it was like a different type of actor.
Right.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Much more.
More like romantic comedy somehow.
Yeah, exactly. This was much more like mainstream.
Yes,
you know, and less,
yeah,
commercial. That's it.
Yeah.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I really, really, really like fell in love with it in a really deep way. But it wasn't that it inspired me, but what inspired me about it was that the impossibility of fiction, the fact that even, you know, if you saw it 100 times, it would always be the same temporal space that was explored, you know, like a few events, the same events. Like it wouldn't change upon revisiting, basically.
No.
But as a 12 or 13-year-old, I thought somehow that by going again and again, something would happen and I'd see, like, it wouldn't be the same.
Wow.
You know, there'd be like
you would
like
change molecularly in yourself, or that suddenly
that
you would
suddenly
like unlock
I'd unlock something by my devotion to this,
like a portal
and
that would open
and
up,
nothing
yeah.
did,
like another dimension.
Yeah.
But you wanted to affect people in the way that movie affected you.
I missed. I had a longing for the world in that film.
I relate to that
yeah,
so much.
And I
remember
to go back.
When I read that, I was like, it made me go back to two movies I saw as a kid, The Goonies.
Yeah.
When that finished, I would then watch it again and just be like, I want to be a Goonie.
There.
I want to be there. I want to be doing all of that.
Yeah.
And then Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams. When they stand up on the tables at the end, I was just like, my captain. I'm like, I want to be in that class.
Yeah.
And when the film finished, I'd be like, I want to have that experience. I want that person in my life.
Exactly. That's the power of cinema.
Yes.
Is that it really can like suspend your disbelief in this way, and it can, you know, it can touch on very, very like delicate types of affects. So that to me was like, wow, I can't believe that we as a species have the possibility of doing that, of creating something that could make someone else want that so much.
Yeah.
So I was like, I want to do that. I want to be able to make something that you would want to come back to.
Yeah, revisit.
Yeah.
Is that why you stayed with your, for the last 5 years, been exploring this theme that you stayed in?
I think, but it's also, it's just a really good organising pattern. Do you know what I mean? To be like, okay, I'm making these characters.
Yeah, it's quite a productive thing.
Yeah,
it is. Like a lot can come out of those. It's like setting yourself a rule.
Yeah.
And then out of that rule, you actually end endless possibilities. Yeah, exactly.
How do you know when it's cohesive?
Well, it's a decision.
Uh-huh.
It's just, well, there are two things. I think that, like, one thing was that my politics changed throughout the project and that I was more naive when I started it. Mm. And I was discovering feminism while I was making the project. And I think that when I first started, I felt it was, you know, like the art could have this incredible role, which I'm not sure anymore about.
Okay.
I thought that I could...
have an incredible role in the world of changing...
Politics.
Yeah.
Okay. And I thought that it was really important to write, you know, inscribe feminized experiences into culture, which I think is important.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think that through reading, I realized that, you know, there are material realities to feminism that are being fought in very different arenas, and that people are putting themselves in danger, you know, so that other people can live safely, basically.
Like who? Like what examples?
Like activists, people that are really, you know, at the forefront.
Mm. And we're talking about this country or universally?
Universally. And I think, you know, that what intersectional feminism is, that is not a white kind of feminism, you know, that thinks about race, thinks about class, thinks about these things. I think it then, like, changes also how what you see your role is. Mm. You know, like, you're a contributor, you're not an author anymore. Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
And I think that, like, for me, it became important to think about feminism as a material reality, you know, what its aims are in addressing a material reality that I'm very privileged in.
Mm.
And that the art world is a very privileged arena in. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So how is that changing your work? I mean, how do you continue making work?
Yeah, it's
feeling that.
Yeah, it is difficult. And it is difficult thinking about what do you do then? Like, what? But I think it's a process, and you take time to absorb this project. For me, I'm still kind of absorbing a lot of it.
Yeah.
Talking about a lot of the outcomes. I think there are important things that, for me anyway, that have come out of it.
Right.
But, like, I don't know if this kind of declarative, fantastical, you know, arena, platform, whatever, you know, that I created with this project, I feel like its use has been fulfilled.
Used up, or
I don't see the urgency.
So does something like winning the Turner Prize give a button on that now? You feel like, okay, that's a really lovely way to round this up.
I felt that in Glasgow already, right, though, because I knew that was it. Like, I did the 12
before
characters.
You got the nomination.
Yeah, definitely. And then when the nomination came in, I knew that, you know, a different audience would be encountering it, which is amazing.
Exposed to you and your work, yeah.
And, you know, and I think also that, I mean, it's that difficult tension between thinking about, like, in the art world and in academia, which is where I am situated. You know, I'm not a commercial artist. My practice sits very much within, like, a kind of academic discourse.
Work seems institutional, exactly. Yeah.
And in those places, you take for granted also. I mean, it's that difficult tension where, on one hand, you take for granted what people, like, people's positions socially, you know, because you're surrounded by people that think similarly to you.
Yeah.
Your disagreements are very, you know, are about nuance as opposed to huge kind of...
Yeah.
And then you think...
With
the
close people you surround yourself
like people you teach with, people you exhibit with.
Yeah.
So, you know, your conversations are very like, oh yeah, now maybe it's old hat, or, you know, like, what's the new thing? Or, you know, there's always a kind of desire to kind of push further. But then you also forget that, like, there are people that, for them, they're just discovering feminism, or they're just discovering these things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that socially, these things are only beginning to on one hand, like, good things are happening with it, yeah. but it's also being cannibalized by capitalism and losing a lot of its power as well, you know? Mm. So it's that weird tension where on one hand you're like, it's still really important. I still really want to make work about it. But then how do you talk about, you know, your own privilege in that situation, mm. the privilege of the place where you're making the work, mm. you know? It's difficult to find ways to kind of push it further in that way. Mm. So, I mean, like for me, I definitely feel like the work I'm making now is more personal than that was.
Right.
If that makes
sense. Yeah, that's...
Although it was really personal, but yeah. like, yeah.
You've gone deep. You've gone a layer deeper.
Yeah. And yeah.
With more knowledge, more information. Now you're like yeah. digested that and you burrowed deeper. Yeah.
Really important thing is that you are questioning it all and you're not just sort of going to be an island like on your own. And you are thinking about intersectional feminism, which you have to because that's, you know.
It's the only way.
That's
yeah.
the only way. Yeah. And it's really important.
Mm. Yeah.
And the fact that you, I think you need to still be part of the dialogue. It's not like you should stop.
Yeah. And I want to, of course, yeah, of course. But I'm just figuring out what, you
yeah,
know,
what,
like
what that is. Yeah.
Because like kind of saying this is, you know, maybe saying this is my imaginary world mm. is not the right strategy but right now. With, do you know what I mean?
Then so it's how politics fits into that imaginary world. Yeah. How you can make, I think you said that how politics can be iterated in a fantastical context.
Yeah.
And that's what you're trying to
yeah.
work out.
Yeah. And
that's
also
quite
like
a big thing to try
it is,
and like.
But like, I think the idea of the fantastical or the yeah. imaginary has always been a strong force in politics. I don't think it's a new, you know, I don't think I've created that. That's mm. always been there. You know, yeah. like all struggles have Afrofuturism or, you know, all these different kind of strands of speculative fiction have often had very strong political aims within it. You know, right. Russian communism was used science fiction all the time.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of talk about capitalism.
Space. There was always space in
yeah.
there, wasn't there?
Yeah. And also just like, you know, films that had like... that critiqued capitalism in a very specific way, but as if it's science fiction. You know, science fiction is always about the contemporary, ultimately.
Yeah.
It's never about any...
It's about the future.
But it's about now, actually.
Is it?
Yeah. It's the best... It's like, if you look, even aesthetically, at like 1960s future, like science fiction films,
yeah,
they're actually the most distilled, perfect visual... expression of the era
of
within
the era,
their make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
It's always like that.
I never thought of that. Okay.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's true, yeah.
The other thing I really like about the two things, well, I loved, just like you've been talking about this whole idea of science fiction and why that was so important in your work and also how I think you've managed to think a lot about otherness and kind of a non-binary kind of
Queerness
and all that, but beyond even queerness, kind of like just like the idea of otherness and how strong that is in your work and how I think there is definitely, you know, through the privilege you have, A, from having grown up with a creative family who supported you and you were open-minded anyway, but also, I guess, the fact we're white and we have, you know, we're in an art world that supports us and we have institutions support us. I feel like you help to use that platform for others and to promote ideas of otherness. So mm-hmm. it's not like you're sort of just doing it for your own gain. I feel like you've got a solidarity and whether you consciously had it or not. And that's kind of why I've respected what you're doing because...
I try.
Yeah, I mean, I think... And yeah. the fact you are trying though, but that's great, you know, and that's the only thing you can do, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, it's... Yeah, I do try. I do try and, you know, like this idea of a city of women, I was very worried when I was nominated that, you know, like it would be misconstrued.
Right.
As a space that... was for cis women only, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and I wanted it to be very clear that it's a space that's inclusive mm. and that it's not, I mean, a space that it's just a bloody installation, do you yeah. know what I mean? But like conceptually that it's not like for cis women.
Yeah.
And particularly in the UK, I feel there's such a disgusting, horrible treatment of trans people here.
Mm, yeah. mm.
I find it really like... I can't get my head around how mean and violent and
but
awful
as a feminist, as a the way that there's a feminist transphobia, which
yeah.
is, I think that's what you're really talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a transphobia overall, but
yeah.
there's a real like staunch feminist view of
yeah,
transgender.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I find it unacceptable. I find it completely unacceptable. I find it mean and so like regressive
mm.
and just I don't quite understand how it's been given such a mainstream platform as it has. You know, there's like people talk about it like debate. Like trans people don't have to convince other people for their right to live.
No.
Do you know what I mean? And it's being framed as like, let's listen to both sides. There's no sides here. You
there's
know,
no right or wrong. It's like they just
want to. Trans yeah. people want to live
yeah.
and be whatever they want to be, and no one else should be telling them what to do.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah.
Like, but obviously, you know, there's a huge contingent in the British media, Mumsnet kind of feminists, that feel very strongly, and I think they're completely I'm going to get so, well, if Ooh. They hear this, but they're delusional. They're completely, their idea of like equality is so toxic. It's the idea that we would then be equal within like, you know, like that we'd be, that equality means having our own, like for cis women to have another group to victimize. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And I just find that really deranged, to be honest.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No,
it?
Not at all.
If you've been oppressed, why would you then yeah, why would you want to have it
exactly
yeah.
and why would you want to be a gatekeeper? Like I have no right to say who can be whatever. Why do people feel they should be convinced? You know, it's like that's the whole point, is that like no one has the right to bestow equality or permission on anyone else.
Yeah.
And that's what's wrong, is that a lot of people feel like in the UK they have to be convinced, you know, like tell me a good argument why trans women, you know, should be allowed to use toilets or whatever.
Restrooms, yeah.
yeah, it's like it's not up to you to decide. That's the whole point.
Yeah,
it's not for you.
So is this feeding into this new work you're making?
No, but I mean that's like my political positions. I use my visibility to yeah. talk about these things. I mean, in the work, it's very clear that I don't have a binary position about gender, but I do use my platform to also try and, you know, like be an ally to trans women
yeah.
or Palestinian people. Yeah. You know, there's certain things that I feel strongly.
And has there been a lot more visibility since winning the Turner Prize?
Yeah, I mean the trans anti-trans activists, TERFs as they're known. You know, they contacted Turner Contemporary to get my nomination to try and have my
withdrawn.
Yeah, because wow. because they've, you know, because of what I said about supporting trans rights. So, you know, it's just weird, like suddenly where you
but it's also incredible that you've had that effect on people.
No, but they're like that. They're like that. They'll like, you know, Google in Twitter. Right.
And they find the person to hijack.
Yeah, person, yeah.
Yeah,
well, this is a common thing now.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is like that church in the States, isn't it, that goes and pickets like events where there's like, you know, God hates fags
yeah,
and all
exactly.
that sort of thing. They hold
exactly.
them placards up. Exactly. It's like these people find people.
They hijack well-known people or anyone that's got any visibility in order for their own cause.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's like they, and you know, I'm not going to start like, but they'll go to like events where yes. they know they'll be unhappy with the ideology
right.
to then try and like attract, you know, like a kind of mass trolling on them. But
have you experienced trolling?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
How do you deal with it?
I mean, you have to ignore it really, because I mean, you know, there was one time I tried to start answering.
Oh my God.
It's not a
it's
good idea.
Isn't
yeah.
It?
Yeah. And also like you could spend days. You know, because it's also, you give if you answer, it's like there's suddenly you...
They multiply, they breed.
Yeah, and also they want to re-engage and re-engage and re-engage. I've had really bad trolling from TERFs, and I've had...
Why are they called TERFs?
It's Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists. It's an acronym.
And how many of them are there?
A lot in this country, too many.
And they're active, they're like...
They're very active, and, you know, like The Guardian will often publish really anti-trans articles saying like, let's have a conversation, you know, like let's debate this. It's like, I don't understand why. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, shall we start debating if like, you know, people want to live in a completely, you know what I mean?
It doesn't make,
I just don't understand why it's given so much airtime.
Why people
here.
Are like, just let them live. Let people just make their decisions.
Totally.
Let them do their lives. And then
support them. You know, a lot of, it's a really brave decision to make, and it takes a lot to make it. And
is
I grew
it just
up,
the natural progression of what it is to be human and in a minority, is that you're always going to get attacked, and when that minority becomes like accepted, parenthesis, then they move on to the next thing. Because for a while it would have been being gay, of
exactly.
course.
And I grew up with, like, in Goa, in our house, apart from my dad, all the men there were gay. And all the men that I grew up with, they, you know, had families that shunned them. They were not accepted by, you know, they had very difficult, like now we live in different kind of social conditions around that. Mm. But they were people that were like bullied, beaten, you know, had very difficult time expressing their identity.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's what's happening now in a way with trans people. But like the short-sightedness of it is really weird. You know, when we know that this has happened, and like the kind of lies that it's, and they use the same kind of
language
and lies.
Why haven't we learned from history? Yeah. It's just repeating itself again, but just another group of people.
Totally. It's just, and I just find it deplorable that the liberal media in this country will like not just take a firm position, because ultimately people that are trans are vulnerable in many different ways.
Mm.
And they have the right to our support, basically.
Maybe because they want the conversation to continue.
They want the conversation to continue.
The media.
It sells,
yeah.
But it's all part of this culture war that we're in now. And, you know, but I think there are things about the culture war that are acceptable and there are things that are not. And I think that people's rights to dignified lives are not ever on the table for debate.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Good.
Agreed.
Wow. I love you. we've never had like a proper like opinion like that. I mean, everyone's got their thing, but we've never had this like real opinion towards something on Talk Art so far. I think that's just amazing.
I think we have deliberately invited certain guests on the show, though, in order to let their voices be heard because they aren't being heard.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, even interviewing Caroline Coon.
She's great.
And,
I love her work.
And now we did a full hour interview talking about only her art. We didn't talk about the punk thing. We didn't talk about her inventing the word punk rock, anything like that. We very briefly touched on it. And I feel proud of that.
On that note, I want to ask you a question that I want you to answer. What is the supernatural back door?
Yes. I think I've referred to that in the past as historical moments where women had somehow through the supernatural backdoor.
Mm.
Sounds quite erotic.
Yes.
eroticism is a theme in your work as well.
Yes.
They've had access to public roles and opportunities to kind of amass influence and power through supernatural means. So like medieval mystics were incredibly revered by the church at the time. They were seen as very close to the divine, very porous and open to divinity, and their writing was seen as, you know, almost like a kind of interpretation of a very direct divine.
Then, well, like the Dalai Lama is in direct contact with God, sort of thing.
Okay. So, Pope as well. No? Well,
yes, yeah. But these were like women that were not necessarily rich, or you know, they were like they wrote about like very erotic, you know, like Teresa of Avila wrote about very erotic encounters with the divine, like very bodily kind of corporal things. And then obviously that influence was then became suspicion and they were then perceived as witches and burnt. But there was this like time where they were seen as like very powerful in different ways. And then you have writers of Gothic fiction. So again, like this kind of Anne Radcliffe, Mary Shelley, you know, like writers who suddenly like Gothic fiction became a really big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was women writing it under pseudonyms or not only, obviously, but, you know, suddenly there was like this platform where there was an appetite for these kind of fictions that were very, again, supernatural. And, and then mediums like during Victorian, like the Victorian spiritual renaissance, where a lot of the spiritualists, the biggest ones, the most influential ones that were being consulted, you know, during wartime were women, you know, and they were seen again as ones that like were able to facilitate this communication with the beyond.
And they got in the back door through their supernatural abilities. Do you believe in the supernatural?
I believe in all the natures.
Have you ever seen a ghost?
I don't believe in a kind of afterlife in the way that we see it.
Mm.
But I've felt strange things. Mm.
I saw a ghost dog once. Yes.
What was it?
Not many people believe me, but I definitely saw a ghost dog.
What did
dog.
You see? A dog?
A dog. A ghost dog.
Yeah.
Run up the stairs
yeah.
and then run down the hall and went through a door. And I was like, I've just seen a ghost dog. And previously in the house I was in, there was a female medium there, and she was stroking this dog in the air. My friend's mum was like, what's that? She's like, oh, you've got a big white dog in this house. And I swear to God I saw it, but I don't know if I knew that information.
But
then I was talking to someone yesterday and I said about ghosts and everything, and they went, well, if you've seen a ghost dog, has anyone ever seen a ghost dinosaur? And I was like...
And then what did I say?
I don't remember what you said.
I said, yes, I had. I'd seen a ghost pterodactyl.
Oh, yes, he had seen a ghost
dinosaur. I regularly see ghost pterodactyls.
You know what? Yeah, why are there no ghost dinosaur sightings?
It's true. Well, I mean, I think there is... I mean, okay, if I was to believe... Like, if, let's say, there was some kind of empirical proof that there... I don't believe in an afterlife, so that makes ghosts difficult.
Okay.
But let's say if there was some kind of weird proposal where, like, certain maybe actions create some kind of indent in the time-space fabric.
Yep.
That then it comes back somehow or something like that.
Like a strong energy that remains.
Yeah, that remains and then it kind of circulates.
It's almost like an echo or something.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like a repeat
exactly.
of something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if someone said, yes, you know, that happened, that happens, like that's a fact, then it would make sense that like incredibly traumatic events would create that.
They leave
I mean, I have
memory.
Had weird things happen for sure. I've had... Like, I lived in a house years ago and I could hear someone sawing wood at night sometimes. And then I asked the person who'd lived there, and a carpenter had committed suicide in the house.
Oh, my God.
So that was, like, weird. You know, at night I'd be like, where is that coming from?
You must have just been like, I'm sawing all this wood. It won't stop.
It won't stop.
Make it
but
stop.
But you know when you're, like, you're not even scared. You're not thinking, like, this
you,
is creepy.
Because you just go, you take it for granted. You go, yeah. Someone's sawing wood.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know what I'm doing this time of night.
Yeah,
but
why is it coming from? I can't quite place it.
Fire.
So that happened.
Yeah.
And when I was little, I used to hear a procession coming towards us.
The house?
Yeah. And I'd get into bed with my mum and dad because I was so scared, and my right arm would start heating up.
Oh.
And I could hear it coming closer and closer and closer.
For a procession of what, people just marching, singing or chanting or
yeah, like kind of hitting objects together.
My God, that's intense.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that. Okay, I love you. And then there's one more thing that I've connected with you is that, which I love, is the fact that as an artist, you never studied, but you never as an artist had an imposter syndrome, but you have imposter syndrome as an academic.
Yeah, I think it's normal. And apparently, like, some study came out that more women feel that anyway. But I mean...
in an academic term?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, I do and I don't, you know, because it's a weird thing. I do think, yeah, because I haven't studied, you know, sometimes I feel like... What am I doing? Why am I telling people this stuff? Like, how do I know it's true? Or
same.
Like,
yeah. I thought that was an actor starting to do theatre, and then everyone around me had like come out of Lambda or RADA.
Yeah.
And I'm there like from Essex doing drama clubs, working class. They're like, I do my acting and I'm confident I can act.
Yeah.
But all the other stuff, I don't feel worthy to be here, so I'm just going to shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Or like suddenly you're like, wow, why, you know, you're passing on something. I think that what helped me anyway is thinking about my practice, you know, like in art schools, you know, practice is research, like they call, you know, like your practice is your research, basically.
Right.
So I think thinking about it in that way more, and like that I am an expert in what I do.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And I think it's important to have different kinds of teachers as well.
Yeah.
Because otherwise nothing ever changes.
Exactly.
So the fact that you are teaching, that was my first thought when I heard you were a teacher and that you'd been self-taught. I was like, this is brilliant.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Because you're bringing something new. And also, I know that you're somebody that's very open to the new ideas and to young people and you get inspired by that.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's a really positive thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I do love doing it. I'm struggling a little bit to do it whilst I am also making a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's difficult to do both.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But I you
how
know,
many days are you in? You're at the RCA.
This year I'm in less, because I had to cut back a little bit. But usually I'm in 3 days a week, which is right. quite a lot.
And do you like teaching, though?
I do like teaching. I do like the bits where it's the teaching. I'm not crazy about the admin aspect
the bureaucracy
of it.
Side of it.
Who is?
Yeah, I mean, who is?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean,
especially
I do like...
Especially creative. Yeah. I think we're all the same. Yeah. Can't bear it. So we ask every guest who comes on Talk Art two questions. The first one is, if you could steal any artwork that you've seen that could be like a touchstone to you, and you could do an art heist, we will help you. We'll bring vans, cranes, planes, anything you need. It could be huge or tiny, which is good for you because you like scale.
Yeah.
What would you choose to take home?
I'd take Paul Feck's portrait of a dead hippie.
Wow.
Yeah. Where have you seen that?
I love
it. I haven't. I've only seen it in images.
Really?
Yeah. Is it in a private collection?
I'm not sure even where it is.
And what does it look like?
We'd have to do a lot of research.
We have to hunt it down.
He's my favourite artist.
Really?
Yeah, ever, definitely.
Yeah.
It's him. It's a kind of sculpture of him with these beautiful kind of coins, like death mask kind of coins.
Mm.
And he built a ziggurat temple that doesn't exist anymore to house this body, but it's like the most beautiful artwork ever.
And that's like 1967?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, it's perfect. Like, that is my, you know, when I lie in bed at night thinking of how good I want something to be, like, that's splitting the atom for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's your thing. Wow.
That's my, like,
And there's actually quite a lot of documentation.
Yeah.
We could, there's so many things from what you say and talk that relate to me, because I, as an actor, as a performer, I remember when I saw Angels in America, the TV show on HBO, when it was transcribed to TV, and I remember watching that and being so moved that whenever I did acting, I was like, I want to feel like I felt when I watched that show. I want to be in that show when I do this performance.
Yeah.
And that's it. And you talking about that, I think it's that same sort of transformative thing where you're like, you place yourself there and go, that's the pinnacle for me. That for me was everything. Encapsulated everything.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there are many pieces that I really, really love. I love Helen Chadwick.
Yes.
I love Valley Export. There are many artists I really love. You know, I actually still obviously really love the Surrealists. You know, there are many things I really love.
Mm.
But there's something about that, the sensibility of it, the kind of materiality.
Mm.
It's so perfect. It's so kind of light as well as profound. And it kind of... Yeah, it's got an epicness, but an economy of means to it.
Yeah.
I love it.
And actually, thinking about Paul Tech, like the hand.
Yeah.
When I saw your hand, it was one of the questions I was going to ask you and I forgot.
Yeah.
It was about like this theme of the hand and the motif of the hand. Is that also somehow related to Paul Tech or not?
Not really. But I do love the little hand. Yeah. I mean, he's also like so, you know, I don't know if you know his... He did these kind of like pieces of meat in Perspex boxes.
Yes.
Hello, Damien Hirst.
Yes.
I mean, like, come on.
No, it was you an influence for him.
Yeah, big time. But no one knew at the time. He was a very unknown artist.
Totally, yeah. You know but also, there was an amazing book that came out maybe about 15 years ago that was called, maybe 10 years ago even, called Paul Tech, An Artist, which is an incredible book.
I want that book.
But that sums it all up.
I want that book.
Have you not got it?
No.
I'm going to post it to you.
Really?
I have it.
Really?
I have the original first edition.
Because
I will send
you
it to
know
you as
that
a gift.
It's out of print and it's like 200 quid or something.
Do you know what? I'll send it to you as a gift.
Really?
But yeah, I will do, I promise.
Oh my
as soon as you find it, 200 quid, you're like, do you know what? I'll scan it. I'll scan it and email it to you.
No, do you know why? Because I've seen it so much that it's already in...
It's in you.
I've got all the information.
That's quite nice for an artist to refer to themselves.
I would love to send that to you because this has been such a great interview.
As an artist, because so many artists don't like to be an artist.
That's it.
So he's actually claiming
he is.
That.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he is an artist. Yeah. And I think that's the best kind, always. Yeah.
Well, this is nice. Another question we ask all of our guests is, what is your favourite colour, Ty, Shani?
Oh, I'm going to have to say pink. Just
Wow.
And pink was a colour, because actually candy colours appear a lot in your installations and work.
Yeah.
And what is that?
You need to do a pop video as well. That's what I see you doing.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
That might
like
happen,
Katy Perry
actually.
Pop video.
It might happen.
Yeah?
Cool.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yes, a pink. Love that.
Yeah, pink. I mean, pink is very, also Paul Feck, sorry to go back to him, but he loved pink as well.
Mm.
And his pink is like the pink I really love. And it's a very varied colour.
Uh-huh.
You know, like from... If you think about a very like an affective kind of relationship with a very pale pink and a very strong one, they're very different. Mm. You know what I mean? In a way that if you think about other colors, they don't have that range of emotive kind of tone.
Emotional. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, pink can be disgusting.
Uh-huh.
And it can also be, like, the most elegant thing.
Yeah.
You know, it can be garish. It can be totally sophisticated. Like, I love pink. Yeah.
Well, we love you. This has been the most amazing chat. We've covered so much, but I think my favorite thing is
we've never all hung out before, have we? And it feels like we've known you forever. And I heard you say in another interview you did with a curator that you'd worked with, and you said something like, "Oh, this interview's been great because it's nice when you know someone so well."
Yeah.
So you almost have a shorthand with each other.
Rosie Cooper.
And I almost feel like today's been so relaxed.
But you guys have the ghost train forever.
Oh yeah, we do have that connection. But I don't think I knew you back then.
No. But one other thing to add was when you, you know, because you started talking about the Tetley.
Yes.
And I just wanted to say, to give props to Bryony Bond at the Tetley.
Bryony's
because
amazing.
Because she is amazing. Yeah. And she was the first person that said, let's make this happen about this project, actually. When everyone was like, you're mad. And like, you know, who's going to give you the money?
You know what? She did the same with Jessie Flood Paddock. She's and great. She said to Jessie, you can do anything you want. And Jessie did this giant lion's head.
Yeah.
And does have that wonderful, there's certain great gallerists and certain great curators who will make ideas possible.
Yeah.
Like, who love artists.
Help facilitate.
She loves artists.
She does love artists. She loves big ideas.
She does. Yeah. And she traveled across the UK with me.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, to go and have meetings with partners to get other people on board. She's brilliant.
Bryony Bond,
you're great.
Thank
you so much. Well, from us and Colin Fuck, we would like to say thank you so much for coming on.
There's a rom-com coming soon.
All images of everything we talked about today will be on the Instagram page at TallCard. And Ty, do you have an Instagram page?
Yes.
What's that?
I think it's just my name.
Ty Shani.
I think so.
Cool. Maybe okay. And the website. As well as check it out. All your work can be seen on the website.
I haven't updated it.
No, but also you can buy a set of 12 prints on your website in the shop, which look really beautiful.
They're
kind of like cards, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
And you've got your book now as well,
which
is just
Our
being
Fatal
published.
Our Fatal Magic.
Yeah, Our Fatal Magic. Yep. Wonderful.
That's your writing.
And your fanzine as well, Buried.
Yes, but I think that they're all sold out.
Oh, they're sold out.
Yeah.
Because that looks really cool.
Maybe you can send a copy to Rob as an art swap.
I'll try.
She hasn't got one. I'll find it on Amazon.
I can ask the person. He's doing a compendium.
Oh wow!
Because I'll tell you about that.
Anyway, we don't need non swap because it's a gift from TallCard.
Oh.
It's a gift.
But we will be back very soon.
Thank you, Ty Shani.
Thank you so much for coming on. That was amazing.
Yeah, more soon.
Cheers, guys.
Bye.
That was fucking brilliant.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.